organizing, recruiting, buttonholing brothers and sisters on the street, speaking to rapt audiences, Malcolm X brought scores of new members to New York's Temple Seven. He also established new temples in Hartford and Atlanta, and spurred more growth in the Philadelphia, Boston, and Springfield, Massachusetts temples. He spent so much time traveling that the nation provided him with a car. His life became one of constant motion, lecturing, teaching, spreading the word of Islam. He brought thousands of new members into the fold, and his words touched many thousands more. He was a dynamo, charismatic, dedicated, articulate, and, as noted by increasing numbers of Muslim sisters, single.
I had always been very careful to stay completely clear of any personal closeness with any of the Muslim sisters. My total commitment to Islam demanded having no interest, especially I felt no women. In almost every temple, at least one single sister had let out some broad hint that she thought I needed a wife, so I always made it clear that marriage had no interest for me whatsoever. I was too busy. Every month when I went to Chicago, I would find that some sister had written complaining to Mr. Muhammad that I had talked so hard against women when I taught our special classes about the different natures of the two sexes. Now, Islam has very strict laws and teachings about women, the core of them being that the true nature of a man is to be strong, and a woman's true nature is to be weak. And while a man must at all times respect his woman, at the same time he needs to understand that he must control her if he expects to get her respect. But in those days, I had my own personal reasons. I wouldn't have considered it possible for me to love any woman. I had too much experience that women were only tricky, deceitful, untrustworthy flesh. I had seen too many men ruined, or at least tied down, or in some other way messed up by women. Women talk too much. To tell a woman not to talk was like telling Jesse James not to carry a gun, or telling a hen not to cackle. Can you imagine Jesse James without a gun, or a hen that didn't cackle? And for anyone in any kind of leadership position, such as I was, the worst thing in the world that he could have was the wrong woman. Even Samson, the world's strongest man, was destroyed by the woman who slept in his arms. She was the one whose words hurt him. Anyway, it had been 10 years since I thought anything about any mistress, I guess, and as a minister now, I was thinking even less about getting any wife. And Mr. Muhammad himself encouraged me to stay single. This sister, well, in 1956, she joined Temple, not with the slightest interest, you understand. For about the next year, I just noticed her. You know, she never would have dreamed I was even thinking about her. In fact, probably you couldn't have convinced I even knew her name. Sister Betty X. She was tall, brown skin, darker than I was, and she had brown eyes. I knew she was a native of Detroit, and that she had been a student at Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, an education major. She was in New York in one of the big hospitals' school of nursing. She lectured to the Muslim girls in women's classes on hygiene and medical facts. One day, I thought it would help the women's classes if I took her, just because she happened to be an instructor, to the Museum of Natural History. I wanted to show her some museum displays having to do with the Tree of Evolution that would help her in her lectures. I could show her proofs of Mr. Muhammad's teachings of such things as that the filthy pig is only a large rodent. The pig is a graft between a rat, a cat, and a dog, Mr. Muhammad taught us. When I mentioned my idea to Sister Betty X, I made it very clear that it was just to help her lectures to her sisters. I had even convinced myself that this was the only reason. Then, by the time of the afternoon I said we would go, well, I told her I had to cancel the trip, that something important had come up. She said, "Well, you sure waited long enough to tell me, Brother Minister, I was just ready to walk out the door." So I told her, "Well, all right, just come on then. I'd make it somehow. But I wasn't going to have much time." While we were down there, offhandedly, I asked her all kinds of things. I just wanted some idea of her thinking. You understand? I mean, how she thought. I was halfway impressed by her intelligence and also her education. In those days, she was one of those few whom we had attracted who had attended college. Then, right after that, one of the older sisters confided to me a personal problem that Sister Betty X was having. I was really surprised that when she had had the chance, Sister Betty X had not mentioned anything to me about it. Every Muslim minister is always hearing the problems of young people whose parents have ostracized them for becoming Muslims. Well, when Sister Betty X told her foster parents who were financing her education that she was a Muslim, they gave her a choice. Leave the Muslims, or they'd cut off her nursing school. It was right near the end of her term, but was hanging on to Islam. She began taking babysitting jobs for some of the doctors who lived on the grounds of the hospital where she was training. In my position, I would never have made any move without thinking how it would affect the Nation of Islam organization as a whole. I got to turning it over in my mind. What would happen if I just should happen sometime to think about getting married to somebody? For instance, Sister Betty X. Although it could be any sister in any temple, but Sister Betty X, for instance, would just happen to be the right height for somebody of my height, and also the right age. I was so shocked at myself when I realized what I was thinking, I quit going anywhere near Sister Betty X or anywhere I knew she would be. If she came into our restaurant and I was there, I went out somewhere. I was glad I knew that she had no idea what I'd been thinking about. My not talking to her wouldn't give her any reason to think anything, since there had never been one personal word spoken between us, even if she had thought anything. I studied about if I just should happen to say something to her, what would her position be, because she wasn't going to get any chance to embarrass me. I had heard too many women bragging, "I told that chump, get lost." I had too much experience of the kind to make a man very cautious. I wasn't about to say any of that romance stuff that Hollywood and television had filled women's heads with. If I was going to do something, I was going to do it directly. And anything I was going to do, I was going to do my way. And because I wanted to do it, not because I saw somebody do it or read about it in a book or saw it in a moving picture somewhere. I told Mr. Muhammad when I visited him in Chicago that month that I was thinking about a very serious step. And he smiled when he heard what it was. I told him that I was just thinking about it, that was all. Mr. Muhammad said that he'd like to meet this sister. The nation by this time was financially able to bear the expenses so that instructor sisters from different temples could be sent to Chicago to attend the headquarters temple 2 women's classes and, while there, to meet the Honorable Elijah Muhammad in person. Sister Betty X, of course, knew all about this, so there was no reason for her to think anything of it when it was arranged for her to go to Chicago. And like all visiting instructor sisters, she was the house guest of the messenger and Sister Clara Muhammad. Mr. Muhammad told me that he thought Sister Betty X was a fine sister. If you're thinking about doing a thing, you ought to make up your mind if you're going to do it or not do it. One Sunday night after the Temple 7 meeting, I drove my car out in the Garden State Parkway. I was on my way to visit my brother Wilfred in Detroit. Wilfred, the year before, in 1957, had been made the minister of Detroit's Temple No. 1. I hadn't seen him or any of my family in a good while. It was about 10 in the morning when I got inside Detroit. Getting gas at a filling station, I just went to their payphone on a wall. I telephoned Sister Betty X. I had to get information to get the number of the nurse's residence at this hospital. Most numbers I memorized, but I had always made it some point never to memorize her number. Somebody got her to the phone, finally. She said, "Oh, hello, Brother Minister." I just said it to her direct. "Look, do you want to get married?" Naturally, she acted all surprised and shocked. The more I have thought about it, to this day, I believe she was always putting on an act, because women know. They know. She said, just like I knew she would, "Yes." Then I said, "Well, I don't have a whole lot of time. She'd better catch a plane to Detroit." So she grabbed a plane. I met her foster parents who lived in Detroit. They had made up by this time. They were very friendly and happily surprised. At least, they acted that way. Then I introduced Sister Betty X at my oldest brother Wilfred's house. I had already asked him where people could get married without a whole lot of mess and waiting. He told me in Indiana. Early the next morning, I picked up Betty at her parents' home. We drove to the first town in Indiana. We found out that only a few days before, the state law had been changed, and now Indiana had a long waiting period. This was the 14th day of January, 1958, a Tuesday. We went far from Lansing, where my brother Philbert lived. I drove there. Philbert was at work when we stopped at his house, and I introduced Betty X. She and Philbert's wife were talking when I found out on the phone that we could get married in one day if we rushed. We got the necessary blood tests, then the license. Where the certificate said religion, I wrote Muslim. Then we went to the Justice of the Peace. An old, hunchbacked white man performed the wedding, and all the witnesses were white. Well, you're supposed to say all the I do's we did. They were all standing there, smiling and watching every move. The old devil said, I pronounce you man and wife, and then kiss your bride. I got her out of there. We drove right back to New York together. The news really shook everybody in Temple 7. Some young brothers looked at me as though I had betrayed them, but everybody else was grinning like Cheshire cats. The sisters just about ate up Betty. I never will forget hearing one exclaim, You got him! That's like I was telling you, the nature of women. She'd got me. That's part of why I never have been able to shake it out of my mind that she knew something all the time. Maybe she did get me. Anyway, we lived for the next 2.5 years in Queens, sharing a house of 2 small apartments with Brother John Ali and his wife of that time. He's now the National Secretary in Chicago. Attila, our oldest daughter, was born in November 1958. She was named for Attila the Hun. He sacked Rome. Shortly after Attila came, we moved to our present 7-room house in the all-black section of Queens, Long Island. Another girl, Kubla, named after Kubla Khan, was born on Christmas Day of 1960. Then Ilyasha, Ilyas is Arabic for Elijah, was born in July of 1962. And in 1964, our 4th daughter, Amala, arrived. I guess by now, I will say, I love Betty. She's the only woman I ever thought about loving. And she's one of the very few, 4 women, whom I have ever trusted. The thing is, Betty's a good Muslim woman and wife. You see, Islam is the only religion that gives both husband and wife true understanding of what love is. The Western love concept, you take it apart, it really is lust. But love transcends just the physical. Love is disposition, behavior, attitude, thoughts, likes, dislikes. These things make a beautiful woman a beautiful wife. This is the beauty that never fades. You find in your Western civilization that when a man's wife's physical beauty fails, she loses her attraction. But Islam teaches us to look into the woman and teaches her to look into us. Betty does this so she understands me. I would even say I don't imagine many other women might put up with the way I am. Awakening this brainwashed black man and telling this arrogant, devilish white man the truth about himself Betty understands is a full-time job. If I have work to do when I am home, the little time I am at home, she lets me have the quiet I need to work in. I'm rarely at home more than half of any week. I have been away as much as 5 months. I never get much chance to take her anywhere, and I know she likes to be with her husband. She is used to my calling her from airports, anywhere from Boston to San Francisco or Miami to Seattle, or here lately, cabling her from Cairo, Accra, or the holy city of Mecca. Once, on the long-distance telephone, Betty told me, in beautiful phrasing, the way she thinks. She said, You are present when you are away. Later that year, after Betty and I were married, I exhausted myself trying to be everywhere at once, trying to help the nation to keep growing. Guest teaching at the temple in Boston, I ended as always. Who among you wish to follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad? And then I saw, in utter astonishment, that among those who were standing was my sister, Ella. We have a saying that those who are the hardest to convince make the best Muslims. And for Ella, it had taken 5 years. I mentioned, you will remember, how in a big city, a sizable organization can remain practically unknown unless something happens that brings it to the general public's attention. Well, certainly no one in the Nation of Islam had any anticipation of the kind of thing that would happen in Harlem one night. 2 white policemen, breaking up a street scuffle between some Negroes, ordered other Negro passerbys to move on. Of these bystanders, 2 happened to be Muslim Brother Johnson Hinton and another brother of Temple 7. They didn't scatter and run the way the white cops wanted. Brother Hinton was attacked with nightsticks. His scalp was split open and a police car came and he was taken to a nearby precinct. The 2nd brother telephoned our restaurant. And with some telephone calls, in less than half an hour, about 50 of Temple 7's men of the Fruit of Islam were standing in ranks formation outside the police precinct house. Other Negroes, curious, came running and gathering in excitement behind the Muslims. The police coming to the station house front door and looking out of the windows couldn't believe what they saw. I went in as minister of Temple 7 and demanded to see our brother. The police first said he wasn't there. Then they admitted he was, but said I couldn't see him. I said that until he was seen and we were sure he received proper medical attention, the Muslims would remain where they were. They were nervous and scared of the gathering crowd outside. When I saw our brother Hinton, it was all I could do to maintain myself. He was only semi-conscious. Blood had bathed his head and face and shoulders. I hope I never again have to withstand seeing another case of sheer police brutality like that. I told the lieutenant in charge that man belongs in the hospital. They called an ambulance. When it came and Brother Hinton was taken to Harlem Hospital, we Muslims followed in loose formations for about 15 blocks along Lenox Avenue, probably the busiest thoroughfare in Harlem. Negroes who had never seen anything like this were coming out of stores and restaurants and bars and enlarging the crowd following us. The crowd was big and angry behind the Muslims in front of Harlem Hospital. Harlem's black people were long since sick and tired of police brutality, and they had never seen any organization of black men take a firm stand as we were. A high police official came up to me saying, "Get those people out of there." I told him that our brothers were standing, told me those others behind them weren't disciplined. I politely told him those others were his problem. When doctors assured us that Brother Hinton was receiving the best of care, I gave the order and slipped away. The other Negroes, but they dispersed also when we left. We wouldn't learn until later that a steel plate would have to be put in Brother Hinton's skull. After that operation, the Nation of Islam helped him to sue. Awarded him over $70,000, the largest police brutality judgment that New York City has ever paid. For New York City's millions of readers of the downtown papers, it was at that time another one of the periodic racial unrest in Harlem stories. It was not played up because of what had happened. But the police department, to be sure, pulled out and carefully studied the file on the Nation of Islam and appraised us with new eyes. Most important, in Harlem, the world's most heavily populated black ghetto, the Amsterdam News made the whole story headline news. And for the first time, the black man, woman, and child in the streets was discussing those Muslims.
The Nation of Islam's relative anonymity was short-lived. In 1959, a network television program, The Mike Wallace Show, presented a report on the Muslims called The Hate That Hate Produced. Did for maximum shock value, the show portrayed the Muslims as a militant black hate group. Reaction to the program was swift. The Muslims were reviled as reverse racists, and their leaders were called demagogues. Dr. C. Eric Lincoln, a black Boston scholar, published a book about the Nation of Islam called The Black Muslims in Inca. The name, Black Muslims, was adopted by the press, and it stuck, despite the nation's efforts to dislodge it. Kumsrow continued to expand. He organized a new temple in Los Angeles. He founded the nation's official newspaper, Muhammad Speaks, and as the national media trained its attention on the Muslims, Malcolm X became their spokesman. On radio and television programs, in newspapers and magazines, he defended the teachings of Elijah Muhammad. He condemned integration and civil rights as phony attempts by the white man to deflect the black man's anger. When he was attacked by prominent black leaders of the civil rights movement, he returned their fire. "Today's Uncle Tom doesn't wear a handkerchief on his head," he said. "This modern 20th century us now often wears a top hat. This Uncle Thomas is a professional Negro. By that I mean his profession is being a Negro for the white man." The popularity of the Nation of Islam exploded. The Cargo, once made up of a few carloads of followers, now consisted of 200 to 300 chartered buses, with hundreds more following in private cars. Muslim-owned businesses were proliferating. Two universities of Islam taught Muslim children in Detroit and Chicago. In 1961, the back page of Muhammad Speaks carried an architect's rendering of a proposed $20 million Islamic center in Chicago. The nation's growth exacted a toll on its leader. Racked by seizures of uncontrollable coughing, Elijah Muhammad moved to Phoenix to relieve his chronic bronchial asthma. As he receded from the public eye, Malcolm X grew correspondingly more prominent. Elijah Muhammad told him, "Brother Malcolm, I want you to become well known, because if you are well known, it will make me better known. But, Brother Malcolm, there is something you need to know. You will grow to be hated when you become well known, because usually people get jealous of public figures."
As far back as 1961, when Mr. Muhammad's illness took that turn for the worse, I had heard chance negative remarks concerning me. I had heard veiled implications. I had noticed other little evidences of the envy and of the jealousy which Mr. Muhammad had prophesied. For example, it was being said that Minister Malcolm is trying to take over the nation. It was being said that I was taking credit for Mr. Muhammad's teachings. It was being said that I was trying to build an empire for myself. It was being said that I loved playing coast-to-coast Mr. Big Shot. When I heard these things, actually, they didn't anger me. They helped me to re-steel my inner resolve that such lies would never become true of me. I would always remember that Mr. Muhammad had prophesied this envy and jealousy. This would help me to ignore it, because I knew that he would understand if he ever should hear such talk. A frequent rumor among non-Muslims was, "Malcolm X is making a pile of money." All Muslims at least knew better than that. Me, making money? The FBI and the CIA and the IRS all combined can't turn up a thing I got beyond a car to drive and a seven-room house to live in. And by now, the Nation of Islam is jealously and greedily trying to take away even that house. I had access to money, yes. Elijah Muhammad would authorize for me any amount that I had asked for. But he knew, as every Muslim official knew, that every nickel and dime I ever got was used to promote the Nation of Islam. My attitude toward money generated the only domestic quarrel that I have ever had with my beloved wife, Betty. As our children increased in number, so did Betty's hints to me that I should put away something for our family. But I refused, and finally we had this argument. I put my foot down. I knew I had in Betty a wife who would sacrifice her life for me if such an occasion ever presented itself to her, but still I told her that too many organizations had been destroyed by leaders who tried to benefit personally, often goaded into it by their wives. We nearly broke up over this argument. I finally convinced Betty that if anything ever happened to me, that the Nation of Islam would take care of her for the rest of her life and of our children until they were grown. I could never have been a bigger fool. In every radio or television appearance, in every newspaper interview, I have always made it crystal clear that I was Mr. Muhammad's representative. Anyone who ever heard me make a public speech during this time knows that at least once a minute I said, "The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches." I would refuse to talk with any person who ever tried any so-called joke about my constant reference to Mr. Muhammad. Whenever anyone said or wrote, "Malcolm X, the number two black Muslim," I would recoil. I have called up reporters and asked them never to use that phrasing again, explaining to them all Muslims are number two after Mr. Muhammad. I believe that no man in the Nation of Islam could have gained the international prominence I gained with the wings Mr. Muhammad had put on me, plus having the freedom that he granted me to take liberties and do things on my own, and still have remained as faithful and selfless a servant to him as I was. I would say that it was in 1962 when I began to notice that less and less about me appeared in our nation's Muhammad Speaks. I learned that Mr. Muhammad's son, Herbert, now the paper's publisher, had instructed that as little as possible be printed about me. In fact, there was more in the Muslim paper about integrationist Negro leaders than there was about me. I could read more about myself in the European, Asian, and African press. I'm not griping about publicity for myself. I already had received more publicity than many world personages. But I resented the fact that the Muslims' own newspaper denied them news of important things being done in their behalf, simply because it happened that I had done the things. I was conducting rallies, trying to propagate Mr. Muhammad's teachings, and because of jealousy and narrow-mindedness, finally I got no coverage at all. For by now an order had been given to completely black me out of the newspaper. But I would put these things out of my mind as they occurred. At least, as much as I humanly could, I put them out of my mind. I'm not trying to make myself seem right and noble. I am telling the truth. I loved the nation and Mr. Muhammad. I lived for the nation and for Mr. Muhammad. But during 1963, I couldn't help being very hypersensitive to my critics in high posts within our nation. I quit selecting certain of my New York brothers and giving them money to go and lay groundwork for new mosques in other cities because slighting remarks were being made about Malcolm's ministers. In a time in America when it was of arch importance for a militant black voice to reach mass audiences, Life magazine wanted to do a personal story of me, and I refused. I refused again when a cover story was offered by Newsweek. I refused again when I could have been a guest on the top-rated Meet the Press television program. Each refusal was a loss for the black man and for the Nation of Islam. Each refusal was a specific loss, and each refusal was made because of Chicago's attitude. There was jealousy because I had been requested to make these featured appearances. When a high-powered rifle slug tore through the back of the NAACP Field Secretary Medgar Evers in Mississippi, I wanted to say the blunt truths that needed to be said. When a bomb was exploded in a Negro Christian church in Birmingham, Alabama, snuffing out the lives of those four beautiful little black girls, I made comments, but not what should have been said about the climate of hate that the American white man was generating and nourishing. Mr. Muhammad made me the nation's first national minister. At a late 1963 rally in Philadelphia, Mr. Muhammad, embracing me, said to that audience before us, "This is my most faithful, hard-working minister. He will follow me until he dies." He had never paid such a compliment to any Muslim. No praise from any other earthly person could have meant more to me. But this would be Mr. Muhammad's and my last public appearance together. Not long before, I had been on the Jerry Williams radio program in Boston when someone handed me an item hot off the Associated Press machine. I read that a chapter of the Louisiana Citizens Council had just offered a $10,000 reward for my death. But the threat of death was much closer to me than somewhere in Louisiana. What I am telling you is the truth. When I discovered who else wanted me dead, I'm telling you, it nearly sent me to Bellevue.